الله أكبر الله أكبر.
Welcome to the Arab Spring, a history. Episode 25, Yom Kippur War. The goal of this episode is to bring the more westerly Middle Eastern states up to 1979, as we left most of them in around 1970. This means catching up with Syria, Egypt, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. In 1969, Nasser had appointed Anwar Sadat as vice president, aware of his declining health. Sadat was a bit of a political nobody. He'd been involved with the revolution and with Nasser's government, but on the edges. He went on diplomatic missions, he'd been in parliament, he'd been on the Revolutionary Command Council, but he was never a minister. The public didn't really know who he was, but despite all this, he was the vice president, and so he became president following the death of Nasser. Sadat was quite moderate when he came to power. He was Nasser's successor. He would do as Nasser had done. Mostly. Nasser had managed to annoy a lot of countries with his actions, and so Sadat began to repair relationships with Turkey, Iran, and a couple of European states. In the spring of 1971, bigger changes started to occur. The vice president, Ali Sabri, was dismissed. When 7 Nasserists in the cabinet resigned in protest, they were arrested. While these ministers wanted to use Sadat as a figurehead, in his short reign, Sadat had managed to become quite popular with the people and the army, and they wanted a strong leader, not a cabal of ministers. This was what would become known as the corrective revolution. This would be a move away from the socialism of Nasser's reign, a move away from the Soviet Union, and a move away from the police state. This, of course, brings us to Israel. The situation was where we left it in episode 18. Israel controlled the Golan Heights, which it had taken from Syria, as well as the old city of Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Sinai. A ceasefire had taken place, but you couldn't really call it a peace. The Suez Canal was closed. Attempts to bring a peace had been talked about, such as the Arab states recognising Israel if they returned to their borders before the Six-Day War, but neither Israel nor America was in any hurry to do that. Egypt appealed to the Soviets for help, asking if they could supply them with arms so that they could cross the canal and invade Sinai. The Soviets were not particularly interested in this. Why do you ask? Détente. The Cold War was reaching a new era, one of mutual respect between the two superpowers. They were both against the idea of nuclear war following the disaster which was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the current situation of fighting wars against proxies was one which suited them both quite nicely. Although even that was losing its luster following the disaster which was befalling the United States as they fought an unwinnable war in Vietnam. The General Secretary of the General Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Leonid Brezhnev, was not going to risk a war with the United States over Egypt, particularly when it looked so unlikely that Egypt would be able to reclaim the Suez Canal and Sinai. As much as people liked Sadat, what really mattered to your average Egyptian was the crisis in Sinai. As the months began to turn into years, and Sadat still hadn't done anything to even begin to rectify the situation, they began to turn against him. Sadat was forced to make a bold move, which he did in the July of 1972. Sadat dismissed all 15,000 Soviet military advisers and service personnel from the country. Popular opinion supported this, and it raised the profile of Egypt in Western eyes. But the West was still not prepared to give arms to Egypt, and Sadat still wasn't able to do anything. Riots began to break out in January 1973, putting the government in a really tricky situation. The current situation was simply not sustainable. Popular opinion couldn't stand Israel controlling so much while the Arabs continued to do nothing. So, someone needed to do something. The Russians weren't going to do anything because they didn't want to upset the Americans. Israel wasn't going to do anything as it was in the dominant position. The Americans weren't going to do anything as Israel was in the dominant position. The other Arab states were in even less of a position to do something than Egypt. So the only way the status quo was going to change would be if Sadat did something. He had exhausted all his options diplomatically, and so felt the only way to change the situation would be to launch a war of limited objectives in order to bring about a more satisfactory peace than the quagmire of stagnation in which he was presently residing. The first step was to gain friends. If Egypt was going to war, she couldn't do it alone. Syria would need to help from the north, and the financial power of Saudi Arabia, which we discussed last time, would also be necessary. Relations had improved with both states from the last years of Nasser. Syria was in a position similar to Egypt. The more radical Ba'athists came to power in a revolution in 1966, but the government was able to do little with the Israeli situation. It was determined to accept no diplomatic peace, but was also unable to do anything militarily. This led the defence minister, Hafez Assad, to make a play at power. He secured the military wing of the Ba'ath in 1970 and became prime minister, and he would become president of Syria in 1971, a position he held until his death in 2000. Hafez Assad was succeeded by his son, Bashar Assad, the current president, but we're not up to that bit just yet. Syria was a predominantly Sunni state, so it should be considered quite remarkable that the Shia Assad was able to set up a government so highly linked with his person. It was in the interests of both Assad and Sadat to get along, so they were allies, but it must be noted that the two had very different aims from their war with Israel. Sadat wanted to force the West, particularly the United States, to change its Middle Eastern policy and view Egypt as a state on par with Israel. In contrast to this, Assad wanted to reclaim Syrian territory from Israel, and to defeat them. The two states planned their attack, and launched it on the night of the 6th of October, 1973. It was the Jewish festival of Yom Kippur, what can be considered the holiest day of the Jewish calendar. It is traditionally spent fasting, and in intensive prayer. The Arab forces had an initial success. Egypt launched 90,000 men, and 850 tanks across the canal, managing to destroy 300 Israeli tanks, while Syria broke through Israeli defences in the Golan Heights. Israel was completely taken aback. Egypt and Syria primarily did the fighting, but Jordan, Iraq, and Morocco sent support, while the oil states boycotted countries which supported Israel. With supplies from the USA, Israel launched a devastating counterattack. First against Syria, which was threatening Galilee. Israel pushed Syrian forces out of the Golan Heights and back into Syria by the 12th of October, eventually settling 30 miles from Damascus. Some suspect that Israel feared to attack Damascus, as it was worried that such an assault would cause the Soviets to get involved. This allowed Israel to turn its attention to Egypt. An Israeli force led by Ariel Sharon broke across the canal. Egyptian generals were reluctant to move their forces back across the canal, as this would be an admission of defeat, but they waited too long. The Israeli force managed to press on, making it to 50 miles from Cairo. Things were beginning to get out of hand. The Americans were supplying Israel and the Soviets Egypt, and neither wanted the situation to escalate. They called for a ceasefire, which was accepted by Egypt, Israel, and eventually Syria. This ceasefire immediately broke down, and tensions began to rise between the superpowers, and war did not look unlikely. Egypt appealed to the Soviets to send troops to enforce a ceasefire. The Soviets threatened to do so, which put the American military on alert, until eventually the Soviets backed down. it was decided to use a UN peacekeeping force, which would not include troops from the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, Britain, China, France, the Soviet Union, and the United States. This brought the Yom Kippur War to an end on the 25th of October. Losses were heavier than in other wars. The Arabs lost more men, but Israel lost a higher percentage of the population. This was in addition to heavy vehicle damage. Israel had won the war, but the initial defeat did a lot of damage. Jewish invincibility had been proved a myth in the Arab world, and the Israeli Labour Party, which had dominated the state since its foundation, lost support, which shifted to the right-wing Likud Party. The Labour Party traditionally won about 40% of the vote, winning 46% in the 1969 election. With the founding of Likud in 1973, in time for the elections of that year, this dropped to 40%, while Likud gained 30%, and in 1977, Labour dropped to 25%, while Likud picked up 33%. This reduced the chance for an Arab-Israeli settlement. As for Egypt, Sadat claimed that actually Egypt won the war. This may have been an exaggeration, but Sadat was able to get what he wanted, a change in the situation. He re-established relations with the United States and was able to build up a good relationship with the newly appointed Secretary of State, Dr. Henry Kissinger. Kissinger was able to broker a deal between Egypt and Israel, which saw Israel pull back from the canal. The canal was reopened in the June of 1975, and repair work could get underway. The person this annoyed particularly was Assad. Kissinger had also brokered a deal between Israel and Syria, that Israel would remove itself from the Golan Heights, but Assad believed that this was the first stage of a real peace settlement, believing that Israel would return to its 1967 borders. Assad came to resent this deal, believing that he'd been deceived by Kissinger, when Kissinger was just trying to help keep the Soviets out of the region. This was perfectly fine with Sadat, who had been increasingly drawn to the West. This was accompanied by economic liberalisation, but it was botched. Investments came in, but it was the wealthy who benefited. Well, as far as the majority was concerned, the principal effects were rising costs. Politics was also loosened, but only moderately. Some opposition was tolerated, but the press was entirely pro-government. As to a permanent peace with Israel, hopes were high following the events of 1976 in the United States. The Republicans were in control of the White House, with President Gerald Ford following the Watergate scandal, which saw the downfall of Richard Nixon. As the 1976 election neared, Ford had to fight a very tough primary campaign against Ronald Reagan to secure the Republican nomination, but it was eventually secured. Events in the Democratic primaries were just as interesting. The Democratic Party was losing its traditional dominance in the Deep South and becoming the party of Northern and Western liberals, which it is today. This reflects the split in candidates for the leadership. Between men such as Jerry Brown of California and Henry Jackson of Washington, when compared to Fred Harris of Oklahoma and Lloyd Bentsen of Texas. As the primary campaign began, the liberal vote was split, and the early victor was someone with no presence on the national stage, former Governor Jimmy Carter of Georgia. Carter campaigned hard in the primaries and managed to secure the Democratic nomination. One of the big advantages which Carter had over some of his competitors, and over Ford in the presidential campaign in particular, was that he was a Washington outsider. His political base was in his state. He was not associated with Washington in any way. He hadn't been a congressman, and he hadn't been a senator. He was just a peanut farmer from Georgia, who happened to become state senator and a governor. This meant that he was not associated with Watergate. The results were very close. Carter gained 51% of the votes, 40.8 million, and 297 electoral college votes, while Ford was only able to gain 48% of the vote, 39.1 million, with 240 electoral college votes. this represented a change in US Middle Eastern policy, as you can probably guess. We've mentioned bits of American politics in previous episodes, but the United States is about to become much more important in the story, and understanding each president is going to be necessary. This will result in discussions of events which would impact the Middle East, like the 1976 presidential election, more often in the narrative. But just what will happen with the peace settlement, we'll have to wait until next time. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please check us out online, thehistoryofpodcast.com, facebook.com/thehistoryofpodcast, twitter.com/thehistoryofpod, and youtube.com/thehistoryofpodcast. It is the best way to stay up to date and find out fun little facts I come across when working on the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks when we see just how this attempt at finding a permanent peace settlement for the Arab-Israeli conflict will go, and whether it will fix all the region's problems. Spoiler alert, it won't. Allah.